Hi, I'm Tyler Foggett. Join me and my colleagues as we go beyond the headlines and deepen your understanding of the forces shaping our world today on The Political Scene, a newly updated podcast from The New Yorker. With episodes 3 times each week, The Political Scene accesses the sharpest minds in politics for insight and analysis about everything from abortion rights to the war in Ukraine. Make sure you're following The Political Scene, available now wherever you get your podcasts.
In a mixed Israeli city, Jews and Palestinians live side by side in peace, mostly.
It's complicated here.
It's complicated?
Here?
Yes. Yeah.
I'm Carol Hills. Online fraud is a huge problem in the UK. British banks say they shouldn't have to pay the price alone. Social media companies need to be on the hook, too.
So much of authorized fraud is starting on their sites.
Also today, the government in South Korea tells striking doctors to return to work. And spyware secretly installed on smartphones harvesting personal information. Dozens of people in Jordan say they were targeted.
You start to think about what was on my phone. You know, what could they have potentially gained access to? That's a conversation that goes on in your head for a long time.
Those stories and more all ahead today on The World. This is The World. I'm Carol Hills. Thanks for being with us today. Israel and Hamas appear to be moving towards an agreement. The deal would halt the fighting in Gaza and set up another hostages for prisoners exchange. The negotiations have been going on for many weeks, relying on intermediaries. There's a lot the two sides still disagree on, but a potential deal could be put in place in the coming days or weeks. This would include a 6-week halt to hostilities, more humanitarian aid for Palestinians in Gaza, and freedom for some Israeli hostages in return for releasing some high-profile Palestinian prisoners from Israeli jails. Of course, all these plans could be derailed at any time. Officials from both Hamas and Israel have issued public statements expressing skepticism about a potential truce. When President Biden said a ceasefire could be reached by Monday, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu reportedly said he was surprised by those remarks. State Department spokesperson Matthew Miller was asked about that today, and here's what he said.
We continue to believe that an agreement is possible. We have made significant progress towards one, as you heard the president say, as you've heard me say, and we're going to continue to work towards it.
While political leaders from several countries argue about the details of a truce, Arab and Jewish citizens in Israel are living side by side. And during a time of war, that can be difficult, even in a place that was supposed to be a model for coexistence. Rebecca Rossman reports from the Israeli city of Lod, not far from Tel Aviv.
The tension here in Lod actually started after a flare-up of violence in the spring of 2021 between Israel and Hamas, which set off tensions inside Israel. For nearly 2 weeks, Jewish and Arab mobs fought each other off on the streets in this town of 100,000 people, and where about a third of the residents are Arab Israelis. Houses were attacked, mosques and synagogues were burned. Two men, one Jewish, one Arab, were killed in the violence. At the time, their relatives came together to make a bold public statement of friendship. Notably, they also blamed the violence on one person in particular, Lod's right-wing mayor Yair Revivo. Some have said that local Jewish and Arab gangs were responsible for creating problems. Others blamed outsiders who came in to make trouble. Today, things have come down on the surface, but it only takes a few minutes of conversations with locals here in Lod's open-air market to discover that both sides feel like they're living inside a pressure cooker. With the events of October 7th, people are more afraid to talk about it openly than ever, as one woman tells me.
It's complicated.
Here?
Yes. Yeah.
That's about as much as she'll say into my microphone before shaking her head in suspicion and walking away. But the man selling her fruit is a bit more chatty. His name is Moshe Cohn. He's in his 60s and wears a yarmulke on his head, suggesting he's an observant Jew. Cohn says when he was growing up in Lod, he had many Arab friends. He still does. Like this woman, Shadia Tantori, who he's known for 40 years. She's come here to do her weekly shop. They grab hands and start reminiscing. She reminds him of the time when her brother found his sister's stolen wallet. Remember how he found it and brought it back to you, she says? Yes, Cohn nods. Of course. But Cohn and Tontori say that growing radicalism on both sides is stirring up hatred and racism in Lode, particularly among younger generations. And he's not optimistic for the future.
It doesn't look good, no, unfortunately. The gap is widening by the year. The reality is the situation is very tense.
But however much Arabs and Jews might want to get along, Arab residents say it's hard to feel like equal citizens, given the lack of resources going into their community. I take a ride through the Arab neighborhood with my producer, Fouad Abu Ghosh.
No sidewalk, it's filthy, it's no signs.
It just looks like undeveloped land, basically.
Yes.
The mayor's office says they recognize the discrepancies and are working to fix them. But spokesman Mendy Zilberstrom disputes that anyone is purposely discriminating against Arab citizens. For 10 years now, we've been working to improve the conditions for Arab residents, he says. We're investing hundreds of thousands of dollars into the Arab neighborhood for infrastructure and to build new buildings. But even these sorts of tensions are nothing compared to what has happened since October. Back at the market, I speak to a young woman named Neda Turi. She's 29 years old, has three kids, and wears a hijab, something that's gotten her more looks than usual from her Jewish neighbors.
In general, you can feel the tension in the air, the way they look at you, the way they talk, the way they speak, the way you hear words. Of course, you can feel it in the air. It's very obvious.
And despite many Arab citizens of Israel having lost relatives in Gaza, in Lod and in other parts of the country, some have been arrested for posting their feelings about the war on social media. But just like the fruit vendor Moshe Cohn, Tori says she blames Jews and Arabs for what's happening in Lod.
Both sides, they don't think of us, the weak people, the ordinary people, the simple people.
When I ask her if she thinks things can change, she says she's young and therefore still has hope. But it's going to take a long time. People are hurt. After October 7th and now the war in Gaza, she doesn't think anyone can forgive and forget the situation. Hopefully it will get better, she says. But it will never go back to the way it once was. For The World, Rebecca Rossman, Lode.
British banks are warning of an epidemic of scams. One financial services trade body in the UK estimates that criminals stole more than $500 million through fraud just in the first half of 2023. A new law will soon force British banks to reimburse the victims of online fraud, but the banks say it's high time for social media companies to shoulder some of that cost. The World's Europe correspondent Orla Barry reports.
Final warning. To receive your package, confirm your details and pay the fee immediately.
Claim your energy bill rebate now.
Amazing holiday offer.
I've had an accident. Send money.
The British government wants people to know that financial scams can pop up anywhere. In this new TV ad, a young man is being bombarded with texts, letters and online ads promising free holidays and tax rebates. The government says an average of 1 in 17 people fell victim to fraud in the UK in the past year. British banks say most of it originated online, on websites like Facebook Marketplace.
Criminals are putting fake adverts, usually on sort of social media or marketplace sites, for goods that just don't exist.
Andy Donald is with UK Finance. It's a trade body that represents British banks and other financial services. Donald says one of the more elaborate scams is what's known as number spoofing. It's what happened to Millie Clark, a dog trainer from Worthing in England.
The people that rang me rang from HSBC's customer care number, which matched on the back of my bank card. And that was the bit that got me hook, line and sinker.
Clark told a UK TV channel that the man who called her said someone was setting up direct debits in her name. She was suspicious, but when she saw his number was the same as the phone number of her bank, she thought, well, it must be genuine. And when he asked her for more account details, she gave them. 15 minutes later, he called back.
And says, your account is under attack now. They've taken out a loan. They've sent it to another bank account of yours. You need to send this money back to a safe account. And they incited that panic, having already built that rapport with me.
The fraudsters stole all of Clark's savings and took out a series of loans in her name, totaling more than $20,000. But Clark was lucky. Her bank agreed to replace all her savings. Andy Donald with UK Finance says banks compensate customers in about two-thirds of cases, even when it's the consumer themselves who authorise the transactions. But he says it isn't fair that the banks are the only ones on the hook.
We think that other sectors have a role to play, particularly the online sector, telecommunication sector, because so much of authorised fraud is starting on their sites.
British bank Lloyds says its research shows a person gets defrauded on a Meta-owned platform like Facebook or Instagram every 7 minutes. Meta spokesperson Philip Milton was called before a UK parliamentary committee this month. Lawmaker Diana Johnson asked him about those findings.
As I said, we take those statistics really seriously. We meet with banks, including Lloyds, regularly.
So you agree that's probably correct, every 7 minutes?
I can't verify those numbers because I haven't been able to see the methodology behind them.
Milton told the committee that Meta spent $5 billion on safety measures last year alone. Lawmaker Tim Houghton asked whether Milton really thought that was enough.
So your turnover last year was actually $134.9 billion, of which you just said you spent $5 billion on safety and security. So that's, what, under 4%? Is that high?
I believe that is a market-leading amount of money to spend on this kind of thing. And I think that's
who are you comparing yourself with? You are the market leaders.
Meta and 11 other tech companies have signed up to an online fraud charter in the UK, agreeing to crack down on scams on their sites. But consumer watchdogs say the platforms are still littered with fake ads. And UK cybersecurity expert Jake Moore says there's a reason the ads are still appearing.
These tech companies are financially motivated, and we can't forget about that. They want to make as much money as they can.
And Moore says the tech giants don't have the best reputation either when it comes to working with law enforcement.
When there is a crime committed and social media is involved, it is still very difficult for police forces to get hold of them.
The UK isn't alone in demanding that tech companies do more about online scams. EU lawmakers are drawing up plans too, which would make social media platforms financially liable for fraud that originates on their sites. Ultimately, though, Andy Donald with UK Finance says it's up to all of us to be vigilant. And if you get a call from your bank that seems suspicious, he says, don't be afraid to hang up. For The World, I'm Orla Barry.
The owners of a quirky and famous pub in the UK have been ordered to rebuild it to its original lopsided dimensions. The Crooked House in Himley, England, was famous for its off-kilter structure.
There was one door leaning to the left, and the next door in front of you was leaning to the right, and a grandfather clock, which looked like it was leaning, but actually it was straight. The rest of the walls around it were crooked.
Himley resident Paul Turner described the pub to The World back in August, right after it burned down in a mysterious fire. The fire took place just 2 weeks after the property had been sold, and then, before the cause of the fire could be determined, the new owner bulldozed it. That raised a lot of questions with locals. Andy Street was the mayor of Himley at the time.
There was no permission to demolish this pub. Very clear. Permission has to be given by the local authority for a demolition to occur. That permission was not given.
Beyond the outrage, the pub's demise was the subject of a criminal investigation. Three people were arrested in connection with the fire, but no one was charged. Now, 6 months after the Crooked House pub was torched and bulldozed, the local council has ordered the owners to rebuild it exactly as it was, crooked walls and all. That should come as a relief for resident Paul Turner, who told us back in August.
It would need to be built as close as possible to what was already there. The place that we've lost is what we want rebuilt.
The owners have 30 days to appeal the council's order. The Crooked House was originally constructed as a farmhouse in 1765. It started sinking on one side as a result of extensive coal mining in the area, and over time turned into a misshapen, iconic structure and a tourist destination. Raise a glass. You're with The World. This is The World. I'm Carol Hills. Civil war in Sudan has been raging now for nearly a year. Conflicts in Gaza and Ukraine have captured far more attention in the global news media. But there's a lot on the line in Sudan, including hopes for stability in the entire Horn of Africa and broader Sahel region. John Prendergast is with The Century, an investigative and policy organization based in Washington, and he's written about what needs to happen to end the conflict in Sudan. His story is in the latest issue of Foreign Affairs and is called Dirty Money is Destroying Sudan. I asked him to map out the foreign actors who are involved in the war in Sudan.
There are two main sides, two parties to the conflict in Sudan, the government army and then a paramilitary militia that splintered off and gone to war with their erstwhile benefactors. And both sides have external supporters that are fueling this war. On the side of the militia, the United Arab Emirates supplies arms and buys illicit gold. And the Wagner Group from Russia, infamous as it is, has also been a major supporter of that militia. On the government side, the government army is supplied and supported by the Egyptian government primarily, but also Iran has increased its support, military support, sending combat drones recently that have helped to alter the course of the war a bit, especially in the capital city of Khartoum recently.
So this is where the dirty money comes in. How are these external actors managing to exploit those resources like gold and make money in the middle of this war?
Well, the vultures come sailing in when there's weakness in the state, when there's massive corruption. In the case of Sudan, a total kleptocracy where literally the government has been hijacked by networks of people who exploit the resources of the country for their own private gain. And so they find international collaborators, and the Emirates has many companies who have benefited from this, especially buying dirty gold from conflict gold from Sudan in violation of all kinds of anti-money laundering standards. The Wagner Group trades basically security support for access to minerals. The country is rich in resources, and gold is the easiest one to smuggle out.
Now, the gold that you're talking about, is the mining for this gold in Sudan going on right now?
Yes. There's major mines in Darfur, again, the epicenter of the violence earlier in this century and now. And also, there's a lot of gold production in the northeastern part of the country, and that's the gold that's being smuggled across the border into Egypt.
So in the case of the UAE making a lot of money off this, is this open and legitimate, or is this all behind the scenes?
It's definitely behind the scenes. You know, the gold that is coming out of Sudan is very clearly conflict gold. It's gold that either is coming directly out of Darfur, which is maybe the biggest humanitarian crisis in the world in terms of numbers of people affected and the level of food insecurity, displacement, all of the different indicators. So this gold is coming from areas where the gold is actually fueling war and people are profiting from the conflict. So they have to hide it.
Now, Egypt and Iran are also trying to cash in on this war in Sudan. How?
There are geopolitical considerations, too. So the money part of it is a part of it. That's the area that I believe there's points of leverage to use. That's why we focused on that in the article, in the Foreign Affairs article. But so Egypt has a long history of supporting the army in Sudan. Iran has deep relationships with Islamist elements within that government, simply as a means of expanding its influence regionally. So Egypt may be profiting or is profiting from the gold smuggling, but I think their primary interest, as is Iran's, is geopolitical.
So what can the international community do to cut off this gold smuggling?
Well, I think that there's a number of things, and the most important one, I think, is to use what are called network sanctions. You know, usually what we see in places of little geopolitical concern like Sudan is you'll see a sanction placed on an individual or a few individuals and maybe a company, and that's it. And then the company changes its name the next day and it continues to do business. So, like, we don't do that in Russia. When the United States places sanctions on Russia, and they place it on entire networks. Individuals, the cutouts that they use to move money, the whole corporate network that goes into the international financial system. And I just feel that at this juncture, given the enormity of the human destruction in Sudan, we're talking about a potential 7 million people facing starvation by June, that this warrants an upgrade in our sanctions response by going after the companies who are profiting from human misery.
You referred to Sudan as a place of little geopolitical consequence compared to places like Russia. Put a fine point on that. Why do some global conflicts command attention and others don't?
You know, there's a history of geopolitical interest where there are tiers almost without, you know, ever stating that. And Africa's always at the bottom. You know, it's perceived to be of little national security interest to the United States. Now, the rhetoric, of course, is, oh, they're our partner. We want to work with government. We want to establish long-term partnerships and build relationships. But the reality is, when it hits the fan, where are we? And I don't think right now, given the scale and scope of the crisis in Sudan, the United States or any European country have stepped up to even remotely to the degree that they step up for people of Ukraine, for example, and other international conflicts where our interests are perceived to be much more important.
It's a big part of the problem here that the Biden administration is relying on countries like the UAE and Egypt and Saudi Arabia to help diffuse tensions in the Mideast, and that that's their priority?
That's it. That's the obstacle. I mean, I do believe there is a great deal of interest, especially in Congress, about Sudan, and has been for decades. The South Sudan war, the North-South war in Sudan, was something that Congress, U.S. Congress, took a great interest in. So many members went there and advocated. And then in Darfur, the Congress pushed and pressed and cajoled successive administrations to do more. But again, the geopolitics of the moment in the Middle East create a real obstacle to pressuring the parties like Egypt and the Emirates to back off from continuing to fuel and fund this war. The issue is raised with our interlocutors in those Middle Eastern countries, but it's raised as point 14, you know, on a 15-point agenda. And the Emirates officials are sitting on the other side of the table, and the Egyptians and the Saudis know that. And so, you know, they know what to take seriously and what not to. And when we say to Emirati officials, you shouldn't be funding a genocidal militia, and again, it's point 14 out of 15, they're like, okay, yeah, we won't, we don't. And business as usual. So that's, unless there are more impactful interactions between the United States and the Emirates, like network sanctions, like anti-money laundering measures, that would get their attention and alter their behavior.
John Prendergast is the co-founder of the investigative group The Sentry. We were discussing Sudan's expanding humanitarian disaster. He spoke with us from New York. You're listening to The World. At this point in our digital history, it's almost a new law of nature.
Our increased reliance on data storage, but also data processing, is driving this demand for data centers.
But there's an environmental cost, and one country in South America is asking tough questions. That's still ahead on The World. This is The World. I'm Carol Hills. Doctors across South Korea walked off the job last week to protest work conditions and low pay. But if they don't return to their jobs tomorrow, South Korea's government says it may revoke their licenses or even arrest them because they say the strike is creating a crisis in the healthcare system. The walkout is led by 9,000 interns and residents, many of whom work 36-hour shifts. But it's not just the long hours they object to. Many young doctors are not happy about the government's plan to increase the number of physicians by creating more spaces in medical schools. I asked The World's Asia correspondent Patrick Nguyen what impact the strike has had on South Korea's healthcare system.
It's pretty serious, Carol. Longer waits at emergency rooms actually running out of beds, cancer treatments postponed. Any surgery that isn't absolutely necessary stands a risk of getting delayed. There was actually a case where a woman in her 80s suffering cardiac arrest couldn't get into an ER and passed away. And the longer the strike goes on, the more backed up the system gets. So it's a really big blow to a healthcare system in South Korea, which is known for having good quality, cheap, universal healthcare.
Now, what puzzles me is that the striking doctors don't like the government's solution, which is to expand the number of doctors. That would seem like something that would help the situation. Why are they against it?
Yeah. So by 2025, the government wants to crank out 5,000 new doctors a year, which is a big increase over the status quo. You would think that the striking doctors would rejoice at having more doctors in the pipeline to relieve the burden. But no, their position is fix our miserable working conditions first and then worry about training up new doctors to relieve the system. Basically, make us the priority first. So officials who are cynical about the strike say, well, these young doctors are just mad because no matter what they say, they benefit from the doctor shortage. It keeps them in demand and it ensures that they have high wages. Once a doctor gets through their residency, they can make a really good salary, like roughly $200,000 a year, which is quite a lot in South Korea.
So is there a shortage of doctors in South Korea or not?
Well, this is clear. There is a shortage. The doctor-to-patient ratio is really bad. It's one of the lowest among developed countries. I talked to Dr. Lee Sang-lim about this. He's an expert at the government's Institute for Health and Social Affairs. And he said a lot of it actually comes down to South Korean baby boomers putting demand on hospitals.
So elderly population is getting bigger. Baby boomers enter the elderly age.
Baby boomers are entering elderly age. So Dr. Lee is one of the country's top demographers. He says South Korea's birth rate is extremely low, and the country has one of the world's most rapidly aging societies. It's a really bad combo. So even now, there aren't enough young people to take care of the boomers who are in their 70s, and the strain will only get worse from here.
Do the striking doctors have the support of the South Korean public?
It doesn't seem that they do. So if you poll regular South Koreans, about 75% of citizens agree with the government's plan to put more doctors in the pipeline. So that shows you their sympathies. Also, just as more and more people hear about emergency rooms turning people away, you are seeing a bigger conversation in South Korea about just frustration with this strike.
The South Korean government seems ready to play some hardball to put an end to this strike. Do you see a resolution on the horizon?
Well, it's still a standoff. South Korea's government says the striking doctors have until the end of the month, but that's Thursday, tomorrow, to knock it off and go back to work. They say, if you come back, no harm, no foul, you won't be punished, but this is your final warning. So if the strike continues, officials have threatened to arrest the doctors who've helped to organize it, pretty serious threat. And also to revoke the medical licenses of those who are on strike. It is a very heavy threat because these are people who've already gone through the trouble of grinding their way through med school. So we will see how far the doctors want to take it. They have about 24 hours to make up their mind.
Patrick Nguyen is the world's Asia correspondent. He spoke with us from Bangkok. Your emails, text messages, and social media accounts, the microphone and camera on your smartphone, along with your calendar, pictures, and location, too. They are all being targeted by spyware. A recent report put out by Meta, formerly Facebook, named 8 different spyware firms based in 3 different countries. But the problem is widespread. The digital rights group Access Now has documented how some 36 journalists, human rights workers, and political activists in the Kingdom of Jordan have been targeted. It's one of the most widespread uses of spyware ever on civil society in that country. Dina Temple-Raston, host of the Click Here podcast, has the story.
Every morning on his drive to work, Dawood Kutab turns the FM dial to 92.5.
ابقوا معنا في فترتنا الإخبارية يومياً على إذاعة راديو البلد وعبر
موقع راديو البلد. That's the station he helps run in Amman, Jordan.
Amanet.net.
I'm a Palestinian journalist living in Jordan. I helped start up different media outlets, and I'm running.
Dawood runs that radio station and a news site, among other things, and he's a bit of a media mogul in Jordan. And he tends to focus on the people and the issues that often get overlooked or even avoided in Jordan.
We give a lot of airtime to marginalized groups, Syrian refugees, disabled men and women. We even have a taxi driver who runs a radio show for taxi drivers.
And while he covers those things, Dawood still has to stay within certain bounds.
There are a lot of restrictions on the media. We're bound by not doing anything to anger a fellow neighboring country or anything that would shake people's confidence in the currency. And the king is immune by constitution, so we cannot criticize the king on radio.
Which means being a journalist in Jordan can be a little tricky.
Anybody who doesn't like facts and information, they might think I'm their enemy.
There are lots of things that make Radio Al-Balad different from other media outlets in Jordan. For one thing, it's independent. It's run by an NGO called Community Media Network. And it's the Hashemite Kingdom's first community radio station. And it's unusual in the region in that it has a kind of good housekeeping seal of approval from Reporters Without Borders, a Paris-based NGO that promotes and defends the freedom of expression around the world.
So Jordan is relatively open society. In the neighborhood and countries in the neighborhood were, if you will, much better, but we're in certainly nothing like Europe or America in terms of the freedoms.
And because Dawood has been working there as a journalist for decades, he knows where the lines are drawn, though sometimes he gets chalk on his cleats. Take the time back in 2021 when there was this huge leak of some 12 million financial documents. They were known as the Pandora Papers, and no one seems to know who leaked them. But what they revealed was jaw-dropping. Everything from where Putin's inner circle had been parking money to former British Prime Minister Tony Blair's real estate purchases to, and this is what caught Dawood's eye, the names of dozens of shell companies linked to Jordan's King Abdullah. The companies appeared to be part of a scheme by the royal family to hide $100 million in luxury properties in the U.S. and U.K. So one of Dawood's editors decided to publish a story about it. And it didn't take long for Dawood to receive angry text messages from the press guy at Jordan's General Intelligence Department. He wanted Dawood to take the story down. And Dawood responded by saying,
"In today's world, you cannot keep bad news away. The best way to deal with a bad story is to present your own story and try to hope that it will not, you know, go viral."
He offered to let the royal family tell their side of the story. They didn't oblige. Instead, another official threatened to pull one of Dawood's radio licenses if the story wasn't taken down. So Dawood felt like he had no choice. He spiked the story. And then he kind of doubled down. He wrote an article about this whole censorship episode for Foreign Policy magazine, and he titled it "How Jordan Censors Journalists." And this is when things got strange for Dawood.
"May we have your attention, please? This is the final call for Middle East Air."
Not long after his Foreign Policy article ran, he was detained at the airport.
It was very unusual. I've never been stopped at any airport. They took me into a police room, and they said, "Please wait," and I waited. And then I called. They said, "If you have relatives that can bail you out, please call them." I did. And I was stopped a total of 2 hours.
Still, Dawood couldn't shake the feeling that something was off, particularly because he couldn't figure one thing out. How did the authorities seem to know so much about his travel plans and have all the legal paperwork drawn up and ready to go in order to detain him at the airport? So he let a friend of his who worked in cybersecurity take a look at his phone, just to check if maybe something was on there that shouldn't be. And that's when things became a little clearer. The friend called him up and said,
"Did you know that your phone was infiltrated?" And he said, "You know, the date is like 2 weeks before you were arrested."
His phone had been infected with a brand of commercial spyware that appears to be just about everywhere these days. It's called Pegasus. The power of Pegasus is well known. It gives whoever planted it a kind of spy in your pocket. It can listen to calls, gobble up emails and texts, even turn on the phone's camera. And it's particularly nefarious because you don't have to click on anything to install it.
Pegasus and similar spyware uses what are called zero-click exploits.
That's John Scott Railton, a senior researcher at the Citizen Lab at the University of Toronto's Monk School.
zero-click exploit, you wouldn't see anything. You wouldn't get a text message or an email. Your phone would just be uninfected 1 minute and then a spy in your pocket the next moment.
It just finds some vulnerability on your phone and takes advantage of it in the background without you even knowing. Pegasus is considered so sophisticated, the New York Times Magazine dubbed it the world's most powerful cyber weapon. And John agrees.
1 minute, your phone is yours, filled with your private data. And the next minute, some autocrat, perhaps halfway around the world, is dumping your digital life out on the proverbial table. That's what's so scary about this technology.
If you ask NSO Group Technologies, the Israeli company that created Pegasus, they'd say they only sell it to nation states for national security purposes. One of Pegasus's early adopters was Mexico. They used it to spy on the drug cartels and to help them roll up drug lords. NSO said that anyone using their spyware on civil society is doing so without their permission. They declined our request for an interview. John, for his part, says it would be naive to think Pegasus wouldn't be abused. Which brings us back to Dawood Qutob, the journalist who wrote that foreign policy article about censorship in Jordan, who runs Radio Al-Balad. He doesn't know exactly who infiltrated his phone, but Citizen Lab says Jordan has been using spyware for almost a decade. And while Jordanian officials have denied using Pegasus, and Dawood says he can't prove they have, he's pretty sure he knows what happened.
They realized by listening to my phone that I was traveling, and they made sure all the legal work is there to stop me.
Dawood has suspicions because after publishing that article on censorship, he wasn't just getting stopped at the airport. His life started getting mysteriously more complicated in a lot of different ways.
Certain things started to happen in my work, and all of a sudden, grants that really were not controversial in any way. Stupid excuses were being created to deny us these grants. Delays in paperwork. Lawsuits are being raised against us for reasons that are not really serious. And basically, there were signals that somebody's not happy with what we were doing.
So it seems pretty clear Dawood was being watched.
We don't know who did it. It was the Israelis, it was the Jordanians, it was the Europeans. I have no proof who did it. Was it somebody else listening to me that passed information to the Jordanians? I don't know.
But as a new Access Now report revealed earlier this month, Dawood was far from alone. It documented spyware on the phones of some 35 people from all levels of civil society in Jordan. People like this guy.
My name's Adam Kugel, and I am a deputy Middle East director at Human Rights Watch, and I am also the organization's representative in Jordan.
Adam has been living in Jordan and documenting human rights abuses there for more than 11 years, and he recently discovered Pegasus on his phone, too.
And we were able to confirm pretty quickly that the phone had been infected.
Which, while it wasn't a shock, actually rattled him a bit.
The idea that, you know, you are being directly targeted by, you know, a security apparatus of a country is a little bit, you know, unnerving, number one. Number two, you start to think about what was on my phone. You know, what was there? What could they have potentially gained access to? And you sort of, you know, that's a conversation that goes on in your head for a long time.
It isn't just one and done. John Scott Railton at the Citizen Lab says reinfections are really common.
An operator can reinfect the device whenever that device is doing something that's particularly interesting to them, or perhaps they have it on a regular schedule to pull logs from that device.
There's one Rwandan human rights advocate we talked to who told us Citizen Lab confirmed that her phone seemed to be infected just before she went into meetings with high-ranking UN officials. A journalist in Mexico told us that Pegasus would appear on his phone after a big news story or before a big interview. In its report, Access Now said the effort to plant spyware on the phones of ordinary people like Dawood was relentless. Between February 2022 and September of last year, Pegasus spyware successfully infected Dawood's phone 3 times. And the report documented 7 other unsuccessful attempts between the spring and summer of last year. And there might have been even more infections in Jordan were it not for this thing Apple introduced in the fall of 2022, something they call lockdown mode.
Apple is launching a new lockdown mode for iPhones, Macs, and iPads that will provide extreme protection against hackers.
Apple says it built lockdown mode for a very specific audience, namely individuals who, because of who they are or because of what they do, might be targets of sophisticated digital threats. To activate it, you just have to toggle something, kind of like you do in an iPhone for airplane mode. And then it automatically blocks things Pegasus tends to leverage to get into your phone. Things like message attachments and FaceTime calls from strangers. It even stops invitations for various Apple services. But even with Apple's new lockdown, just the idea that Pegasus could be on a phone has managed to affect the way people like Dawood go about their daily lives.
I find myself in this very bad position of having to be more careful, not because I want to be, but because when I'm punished, our whole organization is being punished.
Which means, even if there isn't spyware on his phone right now, it's still making its presence felt. For The World, I'm Dina Temple-Raston.
Dina is the host of the Click Here podcast from Recorded Future News. Find more Click Here episodes wherever you get your podcasts. You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Carol Hills. An interesting story out of South America. Chile is reconsidering big data. On Tuesday, an environmental court there partially suspended Google's license to build a new data center. That's because Chile is dealing with a water crisis, and there's concern about the ecological effects of a giant new data center on the country's water supply. Lauren Bridges is a fellow at the Berkman Klein Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University.
There are two ways that data centers consume water. One is directly through the use of air conditioning. So basically, water's run through air conditioning units to keep the servers cool. Computers, as you know, run pretty hot. And the other way that water is used in data centers is indirectly. So by that, I mean at the source of energy production or in the tech supply chain, in the manufacturing of goods that go into data centers. And some estimates say that around 3/4 of the consumption of water in data centers comes from these indirect sources. So it's actually even more impactful than we often realize.
Now, why is Google looking to build this facility in Chile?
There are several hotspots around the world where data center companies and developers are tending to put data centers. So in Santiago, Chile, it's pretty close to Valparaiso, which is a major node in the global undersea cable network connecting the global internet. So that network connects directly to the United States and to the Asia Pacific. The other reason might be because Santiago has plentiful power, largely coming from renewable energy sources. So it looks quite good for companies like Google to say that they're reducing their overall energy footprint by using renewable sources. But of course, there are other impacts.
So where else in the world are data centers a cause for environmental concerns with regard to water specifically?
We're seeing data centers being developed in water-stressed areas besides Santiago, such as Mexico, just outside of Mexico City, Bogota, Colombia, Lima, Peru, Montevideo, Uruguay, in Singapore, and London at the moment is estimated to be one of the largest data center markets that will in the future face severe water stress.
And are any of those other global locations, are they asking questions about the wisdom of having these data centers?
So development of data centers happens, and then local communities are facing either water restrictions or power restrictions, which is another big issue for data centers. And I think it's going to leave policymakers with several problems on their hands. But at this point, policymakers are tending to take a reactive rather than a proactive approach. There have been some cases where local markets have put what we call a moratorium on data center development. So they put a temporary pause on data center development. And this is because either they're consuming too much power or too much water. So we've seen that in several places around the world, such as Hong Kong and in Frankfurt. and in the Netherlands, for example.
Now, let's turn this whole issue around. Have there been any attempts by big data companies like Google and Meta to build more environmentally friendly data centers?
Yes, absolutely. There's been some progress made in this area. So there are ways to reduce the water footprint of data centers. For example, dropping servers into mineral baths. So these basically keep servers cool and they use less water. There's also other projects. For example, Microsoft has this project in Scotland called Project Natick, that it's dropping a data center into the sea and using the ambient sea temperature to cool the data center. Now, what that might mean for the local impacts on the seawater is still yet to be determined, but there are all kinds of projects going on in order to test ways to reduce their water footprint and their power footprint. But so far, none of these have been rolled out at an industrial scale.
I was asking because almost all of us are only using more and more digital data for work, home, entertainment. So I just wondered what that means for the water supply overall.
So, for example, the recent turn to AI requires a lot of computing power, and that computing happens somewhere else. That computing happens in these data centers that are located in, you know, specific areas around the world. So, yeah, while individual consumers, we are adding to that demand, it's also happening well beyond, you know, what you or I might contribute alone.
Lauren Bridges is a fellow at the Berkman Klein Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University, explaining the ecological impact of data centers. Disney is stepping into the realm of Afrofuturism. Iwaju is a new animated series that begins streaming today. It's the coming-of-age story about a Nigerian girl.
In the face of danger.
And her life in a futuristic city based on Nigeria's largest city, Lagos.
So you want to see the real Lagos?
Yes!
This is a futuristic Lagos with flying cars.
Welcome to Lagos, Nigeria.
There are cute children and forces of evil.
I got you now.
And there's an animal sidekick with some attitude.
Actually, kind of cute. I take that back.
This could be standard Disney movie magic, but the 6-part series has a surprising backstory.
I keep telling people this and they laugh at me, but we're gonna kick Disney's ass in Africa.
That's Hamid Ibrahim speaking in 2018. He's part of a London-based graphic arts startup called Kugali. And yes, he said his team would kick Disney's behind. But Disney reached out and offered to partner with Kugali. It was a gamble for both Disney and for Kugali co-founder Zeki Adeola.
At Kugali, we have our own company culture being run by 3 men from Africa, and we're a company based in the UK. We're a young startup, and then there's Disney with their 100-year-old history, and so they have their own culture.
Even so, Disney gave the creative team license to tell a story that would break new ground. Here's Toluwulakin Olowofoyeku.
Iwaju is a science fiction story set in Lagos, and all the tech is inspired by the needs of Lagos.
And this Lagos has familiar needs. There's unmanageable traffic jams, wealthy neighborhoods standing next to extreme poverty, but there are well-meaning characters trying to bridge the economic gap. A universal story, maybe, but Kugali's Ibrahim says it's one their team made sure was told from an African perspective.
Remember, stories shape our society. Let's shape our stories.
Iwaju, all 6 episodes, go live today on Disney+. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from right here in the Nan and Bill Harris studio. Find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Carol Hills. See you back here tomorrow.